a platter on which to develop a platform. And you see what Mamdani did. This is an era not unlike the 1930s in terms of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the need.
He says free buses. He says freeze the rent. He says that kids have to have free childcare. What's interesting is de Blasio, the most popular program he ever did when people were saying, no, you can't possibly afford this, was this pre-K school for kids all over the city, absolutely free. One of the most popular programs in New York City.
Well, you need people. You know, this is, again, this is not complicated stuff. People do need help with childcare. People are working. Women and men are working harder than ever.
How do
people,
you pay for it?
Well, we're the richest country in the world. We've never been richer. Amy, this is what Democrats have got to say. We pay for it by raising taxes on the wealthy. We pay for it with a wealth tax. We pay for it the ways in which, Teddy Roosevelt, you don't even have to go back to Franklin D. Roosevelt, his fifth cousin Teddy Roosevelt in 1901 was contemplating and developed sort of a wealth tax in terms of an estate tax. There are things that can be done and should be done, and Democrats cannot be afraid of sounding, what, socialist, radical? This is the time for sounding a little bit strong.
You're here in New York City for your film, The Last Class, which is premiering at the Quad in New York City. You are President Trump turned 79 on June 19th, no King's Day protests against his big birthday military parade. 5 million people marched. You just turned 79 as well. You're like 5-6 days apart. Your final message on what needs to happen?
Well, I mean, you know, George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and Donald Trump and I also were born within a month and a half of each other under slightly different signs. Maybe that's the difference. But what has to happen is we've got to have a Democratic Party that is not afraid, that doesn't take big money, that says to big corporations and Wall Street, too bad, we are going to represent the people. That's the direction we're going in, and we're not going to hear anything different. And the corporate Democrats, goodbye.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. It's great to have you in studio. Robert Reich, former labor secretary, best-selling author, subject of the new film, The Last Class, about his last class that he taught last year at UC Berkeley, Wealth and Poverty. Was it over 1,000 students attended that class?
Yep.
Up next, the Trump administration's attack on vaccines. Stay with us.
Recoge solo tus ideas, levanta para acá tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
El día que amanece lento, recoge solo tus ideas, levanta para acá tu mirada para todo lo que venga.
Me está llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire, las horas al viento
me
se entregan.
Llamando.
Semilla que va germinando, paciencia que el enfoque llega, el tiempo que flota en el aire y el viento se entrega.
Me está llamando.
De poco te zapas el miedo, un dedo tras otro lo sueltan, en tu pecho una llamarada que por dentro quema.
Me está llamando.
De poco te zapas el miedo. Un dedo tras otro lo suelta. En tu pecho una llamada que todo lo quema.
Me
te está llamando. Y me está llamando. Óyelo.
Me está llamando.
Un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema. Responda que te está llamando. Responda que te está,
me llamando. Está
llamando. Un fuego que por donde quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema. Un fuego que todo lo quema.
Yama by Maku Sound System, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to public health and vaccines. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has withdrawn a U.S. pledge to fund the world's preeminent international vaccine organization as the Trump administration takes its campaign against vaccinations, led by RFK Jr., global. The organization, known as Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, is the world's largest funder of life-saving vaccinations and says it's helped vaccinate more than 1.1 billion children in 78 lower-income countries, preventing nearly 19 million future deaths. On Wednesday, Kennedy claimed, without any evidence, that Gavi, quote, ignored the science in its global immunization campaign.
Unfortunately, in its zeal to promote universal vaccination, it has neglected the key issue of vaccine safety. When the science was inconvenient, Gavi ignored the science. I call on Gavi today to re-earn the public trust and to justify the $8 billion that America has provided in funding since 2001.
Also Wednesday, scientists at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control rallied outside the agency's headquarters in Atlanta to protest the Trump administration's newly reconstituted vaccine advisory panel. It's called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, known as ACIP. RFK Jr. stacked the committee with new appointees, fired most of the others, many of them holding anti-vaccine views. He fired all 17 formerly seated members of the panel and replaced them with a smaller group of his own. Wednesday was the first day of the new committee's meeting. This is former CDC worker Peter Kieglowski, who was protesting outside.
There have been rallies here every Tuesday since the maybe since March, but today is especially important because this is the first meeting of this new, and I would say bogus, Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, ACIP. Kennedy, as most people know, fired the previous members of ACIP, and the few people that he's put on it are not competent.
For more on these developments, we're joined by Dr. Paul Offit. He's the director of the Vaccine Education Center, attending physician at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, also serves as an advisor to the FDA. Dr. Offit is the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, recommended for universal use in infants by the CDC, author of numerous books, including Autism's False Prophets, Bad Science, Risky Medicine, and The Search for a Cure, as well as the book Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. Dr. Offit, thanks so much for joining us again. If you can start off by talking about this two-day meeting, the first was yesterday, and the whole issue that the people on this committee are saying, they're just re-examining the whole roster of vaccines. What does that mean? How does that affect kids in this country, adults as well, and people around the world?
Well, so anti-vaccine activists have been shouting from the sidelines for decades. Now they're making policy. We have an anti-vaccine activist and science denialist as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who basically fired 17 people who were members of the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, who went through the proper vetting process, made sure they didn't have conflicts of interest, made sure they had the expertise that could give us the advice we needed. He fired all those people. Then what he did is he brought in eight people. Now one of them backed off, so it's seven people who would have never passed the confirmation process, who don't have the expertise we need to give good advice. And what they're doing is they're just putting forward what is typically anti-vaccine tropes, like kids are getting too many vaccines too soon, so we need to reevaluate that. Why are we giving a hepatitis B birth dose, et cetera, et cetera? And so you're now just seeing anti-vaccine activism move into the center of public health.
And Dr. Offit, in fact, the panel chair, Dr. Robert Malone, said he considers the label anti-vaxxer to be high praise. I mean, you've worked in vaccine information, the head director of the Vaccine Education Center. You know, what do you think explains this transformation in the perception of the effectiveness of vaccines, and not just the effectiveness, but what they're propagating, which is the danger of vaccines?
I think that we, to some extent, lost the trust of the American public early in the COVID pandemic. And I think two things happened. I think in 2020, when we didn't have anything, we didn't have antivirals until October, we didn't have monoclonal antibodies till November, we didn't have vaccines till December, to try and stop the spread of a virus that was spread asymptomatically. And so what did we do? We shuttered schools, we closed businesses, we restricted travel, we masked, isolated, quarantined, social distanced, and tested. And I think there was a percentage of this population that thought that was massive government overreach, especially the shuttering of schools and closing of businesses. I think the following year when we had a vaccine, which we did by December of 2020, and that was available by January of 2021, we very quickly vaccinated 70% of this population by July of 2021, but 30% of this population didn't want to be vaccinated. First of all, people didn't like it that you had to have your vaccine passport, which is to say, unless you were vaccinated, you couldn't go to your favorite bar or restaurant or a place of worship, or you may be fired from your job. That, too, was, I think, seen as massive government overreach. And I think we leaned into a libertarian left hook, and I think we're feeling that punch. So everything sort of fell out. I mean, people said, well, COVID's not that big of a deal, or, well, the vaccine is really much more dangerous than they're telling you. They lost the trust in the government, and they were very quick to see conspiracy. And that's how RFK Jr. rose into this position. I mean, what did he say when he fired those 17 people? He said they were rife with conflicts of interest, which wasn't true. He couldn't name one person on that committee who had a conflict of interest that in any way affected their vote, not one. So instead, he just had this broad sweeping, you know, they're all in the pocket of industry, they're all unduly influenced. And then to extend this to Gavi, to the Global Alliance Vaccine Initiative, you couldn't be more short-sighted. How do people think measles comes into this country periodically and can start outbreaks? It's coming from often from outside the country because every year there's millions of cases of measles. There's almost 150,000 deaths from measles in this year. And the Global Alliance Vaccine Initiative has done a lot of good at sort of stopping the spread of things like measles and German measles, et cetera. So it's hard to watch all this.
Dr. Offit, I want to ask you to respond to RFK Jr.'s appointee, the co-chair, Martin Kulldorff, who kicked off Wednesday's panel. He said he's appointing a working group to look at the, quote, cumulative effect of the children's vaccine schedule.
If you have questions or concerns about the safety or efficacy of vaccines, we want to hear them. That is the scientific method, and it is natural to ask questions. That is what the CDC subject matter experts do, it's what the public does, and it is what we will do. No questions should be off limits. Some media outlets have been very harsh on the new members of this committee, issuing false accusations and making concerted efforts to put scientists in either a pro or anti-vaccine box. Such labels undermine critical scientific inquiry, and it further feeds the flames of vaccine hesitancy. As Secretary Kennedy has eloquently stated, opposing mercury in fish does not make you anti-fish, and opposing mercury in vaccines does not make you anti-vaccine. In fact, to thoroughly scrutinize and ensure the safety and efficacy of vaccines is a pro-vaccine position.
So, Dr. Offit, Martin Kulldorff is just saying we're just looking at all of this. But what is your response? And talk not only what it means here. Again, you were referring to Gavi. What this means globally. Why saying evaluation is perfectly innocent and reasonable and scientific.
Well, that's true. I think evaluation is perfectly reasonable, but you don't necessarily need to evaluate things that are already clear. So, for example, when he talks about this notion that we're just getting too many vaccines, that we need to look at the entire vaccine schedule, it shows you that he really doesn't understand the immunology of vaccines, which is true of most of the people sitting around that table. They don't have the expertise in virology or immunology or vaccinology. So, for example, people say, look, I mean, we're asking so much of parents of this country, and it's true. You know, we ask them to give vaccines that prevent 14 different diseases in the first few years of life. That can mean as many as 25 inoculations during that time and as many as 5 shots at one time to prevent diseases most people don't see, using biological fluids most people don't understand. So there's understandable skepticism, and that's fair. But it's not really the number of vaccines that you get that matters. It's the number of immunological components in vaccines that matter. So by immunological component, I mean, for example, a viral protein or a bacterial protein that induces an immune response. That's an immunological component. If you add up all the immunological components in vaccines today, it adds up to about 170. That's less than the one vaccine that we got 100 years ago, the smallpox vaccine, the largest of the mammalian viruses, which had about 200 immunological components. So we have a lesser challenge to the immune system today in vaccines than we did 100 years ago. So I don't think he understands any of that. And I think when he brings these things up is, look, we're just asking questions. And brings up the mercury issue again. I mean, I was on the advisory committee for immunization practices between 1998 and 2003 when this all came up. And this has been well studied. We now have looked at children who get these vaccines that contain this mercury, so-called ethyl mercury preservative, compared it to children who have the same vaccines that didn't contain this mercury-containing preservative. And you know, because we live on this planet and that mercury is in the Earth's crust and that we drink methyl mercury every day, and that we all have methylmercury in our bloodstreams, all of us, methylmercury is in infant formula. It's in breast milk. It's in anything made from water on this planet. What you learned about so-called thimerosal, this ethylmercury-containing preservative, is that it doesn't in any way contribute to a detectable amount of mercury in your bloodstream. You knew that. And then there's now been 9 studies showing that if you get these vaccines, as compared to vaccines that don't contain this preservative, that there's no difference in neurodevelopmental outcome. So when he says, well, we're just asking questions, we're just looking, we've already looked at this. What he's saying is he doesn't trust what's happened before him.
And Dr. Offit, the question about the global impacts of this, first the U.S. cutting funding to Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and then this coupled with the fact that for multiple reasons, vaccination rates in many parts of the world, including poorer countries, have come down in part because of vaccine misinformation that spread and the impact on that on possible future deaths.
Certainly. I mean, we export our fears, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a big exporter of fears. I mean, since he's been an anti-vaccine activist for 20 years through his program, Children's Health Defense, he puts out a lot of misinformation and disinformation. And so, for example, Samoa is a perfect example. There was a tragedy in Samoa where the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is in powdered form there. So you need to dilute it in or reconstitute it in a diluent. Two nurses independently made a mistake where instead of using just the sort of salt water diluent that should have been used, they use a muscle relaxant. They injected independently 2 12-month-old children, both of whom died almost immediately from when they stopped breathing. So what he did immediately through Children's Health Defense is he said in his website and then elsewhere, a measles vaccine is killing children in Samoa when it wasn't a vaccine at all. He then went to Samoa. He met with anti-vaccine activists. He met with the president. He tried to, again, influence people. Measles is killing your children. Immunization rates dropped from about 75% to 30%. And there was a massive measles outbreak in this country of 200,000 people. 5,600 cases of measles, 83 deaths. Mostly in children less than 4 years of age. That he had a lot to do with that. So that's what misinformation can do, not only in this country, where we're again seeing the biggest measles outbreak we've probably seen in 30 years, but in the world.
So finally, 30 seconds, how are you responding to this 2-day meeting and what's going to come out of it?
You're just standing back and watching what is frankly a clown show. I mean, I think the head of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Susan Kresley, said it best. We're not going to this meeting anymore. We're ignoring this meeting. I think most of the medical and scientific community is just seeing this for what it is, which is just another forum for anti-vaccine activists to talk about their misinformation.
Dr. Paul Offit, we want to thank you for being with us. Director of the Vaccine Education Center, attending physician at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Up next, NATO. Stay with us.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. If you love just one nation, then the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice. But God bless the people then who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies. We can bring them to their knees. We can bomb the the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. I sing
Bomb the World to Pieces by Michael Franti in our Democracy Now! Studio years ago. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. This is Democracy Now!
President Trump is back in Washington after the NATO summit, where leaders agreed to increase their military spending to 5% of their GDP by 2035. The NATO summit occurred just days after Trump ordered an attack on three Iranian nuclear sites. This is Trump speaking with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte about the Israel-Iran ceasefire, which continues to hold.
They're not going to be fighting each other. They've had it. They've had a big fight, like two kids in a schoolyard. You know, they fight like hell. You can't stop them. Let them fight for about 2-3 minutes. Then it's easier to stop them.
And then daddy has to sometimes use strong language.
You have to use strong language. Every once in a while, you have to use a certain word.
That was President Trump and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who referred to Trump as daddy. Earlier today, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei issued a video statement where he claimed Iran had won the war and vowed that Iran would never surrender.
This all comes as Israel's mass killing in Gaza continues. Palestinian officials say Israeli forces have killed another 90 Palestinians over the last 24 hours, including dozens waiting near new food distribution centers. To talk more about NATO, Iran, and Gaza, we go to London, where we're joined by Gilbert Achkar, Emeritus Professor of Development Studies and International Relations at SOAS, University of London. He's the author of several books, including The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. His recent piece for the French paper Le Monde is headlined History's Crossroads, Gaza or the Failure of the West. And he's writing a new book. It's just about to come out, Gaza Catastrophe, the Genocide in World Historical Perspective. Professor Achkar, it's great to have you with us. Let's start off by what came out of NATO. Trump has been pushing this since his first term, that the 32 member countries spend far more on weapons, which means cutting social programs, green programs. And you have the NATO Secretary General sitting next to him, Mark Rutte, calling Trump daddy. Your response?
Yeah. Good morning, Amy, and good morning, Nermeen. Very nice talking to you. Well, that was a pathetic spectacle that what we've seen, this NATO summit. That was the shortest of all NATO summits, probably. I mean, it was cut to the size that fits the attention span of Donald Trump, which is no longer than 2 hours, seemingly. I mean, if you just imagine that you have 32 countries represented there, just divide the 2 hours by 32, you'll see how long it gives everyone. And the result was, very, very much meant to please Donald Trump. This decision that you mentioned to increase military expenditure to the level of 5% of GDP, which is a very high level, even if you take into account that that means practically 3.5% for strictly military expenditure and 1.5 on security and other kind of related expenditure, that's still absolutely huge. And for many of those 32 countries of NATO, that would mean doubling, more than doubling for some, their military expenditure. And that's absolutely huge and can only happen, as it is happening in the United States, where you have record military budgets with Donald Trump, and cutting in Medicaid, cutting in social expenditure of every kind. You know that better than I know. So that's exactly what is going to happen at the level of the whole of NATO, and is happening. And basically, this meeting was a convergence between two factors. One, the Trump factor, of course, but we have to be aware of the fact that Trump does not really give a damn about NATO itself. He doesn't regard Russia as an enemy. He actually has more affinities with Vladimir Putin than most of these European leaders. And the summit proved that. I mean, there were hardly a mention, just one, of Russia. What he is interested in is catering to the military-industrial complex of the United States. And when he asks these NATO countries to increase their military expenditure, he means by that, buy more U.S. weapons. That's what he is doing. He's a salesperson for the military-industrial complex, along with the Trump Organization and other businesses. With the Gulf countries, it's exactly the same. He got them to promise hundreds of billions of dollars of expenditure on military purchases. And so you have a convergence between that. And now the military-industrial complex of those European countries that have a large military industry, and that is mostly countries like Germany, France, Britain, the United Kingdom, that is, and Poland, and these are the countries that are now pushing for more military expenditure. And you can see that most of the countries where you don't have such industries are very reluctant to follow. So there is this convergence of interest of military industrial complexes wanting more money, more expenditure on means of destruction at the very time when we are lacking every kind of things. And you know, just to give you an illustration of someone who got the lesson, because he is following in the footsteps of the poodle tradition of Tony Blair, and that's Keir Starmer. I mean, he is happily increasing the military budget of the United Kingdom, and part of that is buying, just a very recent decision, 12 F-35 from the United States at a cost that has been estimated overall, hardware plus what comes with it, at close to $2 billion. And that will, I mean, these are planes that will be able to carry nuclear loads, but that would be under U.S. control. I mean, the use of these nuclear weapons. So that's also an abandonment of sovereignty. So you have this from a government in Britain at the time when you have the National Health Service completely understaffed. And there you have Keir Starmer explaining to the public opinion in this country, in Britain, that this purchase of 12 F-35s will create a huge lot of jobs. I mean, this is pitiful, absolutely pitiful.
And Gilbert Rashkar, very quickly, you said that that Trump doesn't care about NATO, but NATO seems to care an enormous amount for Trump. So if you could just say a little bit about that. We just have 30 seconds.
Yes, I mean, it's uneven in NATO, but of course, the closer you get to the Russia, the Russian borders, the more countries are afraid and need or believe that they need U.S. protection. And you have some of those states, the larger states, those who have military-industrial complexes, as I said, if you look at France and Germany in particular, trying to push forward the idea of an autonomous European defense, but it's not very popular in NATO ranks. Even Britain, as I said, does not follow at all that kind of line. Now, this being said, we are witnessing the recurrence of a pattern that was very familiar during the Cold War, where the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex in the United States would inflate considerably the so-called risk, the threat, the communist threat of whatever it is, the threat from the Soviet Union,
in order to increase
their military expenditure. Yep.
We're going to go to part two, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org, so people should check out the website for a web exclusive with Gilbert Rashkar. Professor Emeritus of Development Studies and International Relations at SOAS, the University of London. That does it for our show. We're hiring for multiple positions. Go to democracynow.org/jobs. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Is that a normal part of your singing?
That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll be right back.